Episode 151 of Girl Take the Lead, where each week we explore womanhood and leadership. And I'm your host, Yo Canny. Today we are joined by Christine Cherick to discuss her book, Tread Loudly. In addition to being an author, Christine is an attorney, executive, professor, and philanthropist. We got to talking and it was a lot. So I've broken the conversation into two parts so you wouldn't miss anything. This first part covers strategies, perfectionism, and just going for it. Our second part covers more about just going for it, like Elle Woods, and we cover some data, and Christine offers advice for younger generations. Plus, she'll tell us what she'd tell her 20-something self today. So be sure to listen to both parts. Enjoy the listen. Here you go. Well, Christine, welcome to Girl Take the Lead. We are so happy to have you with us.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
And your book was just so fun. There were so many things I could relate to in it. And I think so many things our listeners are going to really enjoy hearing about. Why don't we start first by you just introducing yourself and telling them about your book?
Sure. First, I'm so pleased to be here to meet with you today, Yo, and to share the message with all of your listeners. My name is Christine Cherick. I, by education, am an attorney. I spent about 20 years of my career in corporate law firms and in big companies, all of which were very male dominated, not only by numbers, but also kind of culture and feel and the way things worked. And I finished my career teaching through a long series of events. My husband and I ended up moving from Wisconsin to Florida for his career. And I made the jump from corporate America to teaching. And taught at a law school here in Florida for about 8 years. And at the time, my students were coming back after their first internships, their first jobs, and telling me about their experiences. And it really sounded too similar to things that I remembered from 20 years prior when I was in their shoes. So I wrote a book about my experiences, my advice, some things I wish I had done differently, hopefully some things and tips to inspire not only my generation, but your daughter's generations, the millennials and Gen Z, to help them navigate the workforce, to find that power and strength within, and to hopefully leave the world a little bit better place for all of us, and to really inspire and empower women to speak up and take charge of their lives and their careers. So the book is called Tread Loudly. And it's a kind of a play on words.
Well, I think when you and I spoke, I said that when I went through my career, it was about being silent and passing and not making a fuss and not, you know, being out there. And I think your book gives us total permission to be ourselves and to be out there. So thank you for that.
Thank you. And I thought that's exactly right. You know, I'm Gen X. So I entered the workforce in the late 1990s. And, you know, at that time, there weren't a lot of women in positions of power. And unfortunately, it hasn't changed that much. But at that time, the work culture was such that we couldn't loudly say, this isn't fair, you're not treating me equally, this system is skewed or wrong or not serving all people. I think had we done that, and I'm guessing you share this opinion, then had we done that, we would have been labeled a troublemaker, a loudmouth, a something, and no one would have listened. So we had to tread very lightly and make what change we could little by little and without, you know, making too many waves, without disrupting the norm too much, but fighting for every little bit of progress that we had. And I think, I hope, and I believe that the world is now at a kind of tipping point where we don't have to tiptoe around these issues anymore. And that's for all the bad mouth that social media gets, I think that's one thing that's been really good, is it gives women the platform and the ability to find their community and to know that you are not alone. And I've really seen with the younger generations, they just don't take as much crap as I did. And I love that. I love that about them. And I want to continue to empower them and hope that they then carry the torch forward.
Right. Well, I think that there's more opportunity for them to have different options. Like for me, back in the 80s, the way that I saw things happening, since I couldn't progress upward, I had to change jobs, move to a different company, you know, interview at a slightly higher level because I wasn't getting promoted within. And that was how I handled it. And I think,
and you did the best you could, right? You
absolutely.
Did the best you could with what you had available at the time.
Exactly. And but you know, you'd get a call from the headhunter to tell you about this other job, and then they would go, "Oh, you've moved around so much." And you know, and I look at it now.
Well, I have to in order to continue
exactly.
to progress. Absolutely.
Exactly. That was kind of what happened for me. Sometimes there were women who were able to move up, but not quite into the C-suite. You know, you could move to like higher middle management, but not quite the executive level. And I know for me, it was like I had to change jobs and I had to change industries in order to kind of get that C-suite, which I did eventually. But it was not easy. And I'm sure it's not easy for anybody right now. So
it isn't. And I think you're right though, that there are more opportunities. There's certainly more attention paid to it. We've seen in recent years, a lot of attention paid to C-suite in particular, lack of women in CEO, CFO, chief marketing officer, chief people officer, general counsel, chief risk, all of those. That's what we mean by C-suite. We've seen more attention paid, particularly at the Fortune 500, at the biggest companies. And they took some heat from media and other activist groups. And there are definitely more opportunities, not as many as we would yet like. And it isn't, I'm sure the path isn't easy for anyone, but certainly from, you know, the 80s or 90s, I pray that it's at least a bit easier.
I get the sense that it, I mean, it's still tons of frustration and,
sure.
But I hope so. I hope with you too, you know, and maybe your voice and my voice and other people's voices will help that. And
that is why we're doing what we're doing.
Exactly. So one of the things that we've talked about in a few places in the podcast has been work friends. And I know, boy, they were so important for me to survive. And what do you see there? Like, why are work friends so important, especially for women?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. When I entered the workforce, I was very lucky to have an incredibly close friend of mine from school, who was my roommate, who was the maid of honor at my wedding, also go to the same company as I did. Now, we were in very different places in the company, very different departments. She was four floors away from me in a tall office building, but I at least had this sort of built-in person who I started my first day with. And I think that made my transition to work dramatically easier. But I didn't work with her or see her on a daily basis. But she was at least someone who I could message and say, "Can you meet me in the lobby? I need to vent, or I need a coffee, or I need a break, or something like
walk.
That.
Mine was always,
I need to breathe. But from my perspective throughout my career, work friends have been incredibly important because you need that person. And hopefully you can find that person. And even if it isn't in your own company, maybe there's someone in a trade group or some association that you belong to, networking group, someone who is going through the same kind of thing as you at that time, or maybe a little ahead or behind you in seniority, who understands the pressure, who understands what you're dealing with in your industry or your business or company. And for me, it was really a sounding board. It was someone who I could be honest with, like truly honest, and say, I have no idea what I'm doing on this project, or I'm terrified I'm not going to meet this deadline. You know, those are things that I wouldn't have shared with even work acquaintances. But to have that person who you know understands and who you know isn't judging you, for me was truly a lifesaver.
And I think you say go for quality, not quantity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, when I went through law school, I saw other people take a very different approach, and they were doing all the social events and clubs and happy hours and things. And they had from the outside what looked like a lot of friends. And I had Marty, that's her name. It was just the two of us. And for me, it was so much more helpful to have this, for me, one person or small number of people who I knew had my back, who I knew I could be absolutely honest with, rather than the quantity of I'm surrounded by eight people all the time and I have all these friends, but are any of those people truly the person who at, you know, midnight you can call and scream or cry if you need to?
Mine was usually crying.
Mine too. Mine too.
Yeah. We've also covered the topic of happiness. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you bring up in the book is, you know, how perfectionism is not happiness. And that was so good. That was so good.
Thank you. And I think that's something that was, it took me a lot of years to understand. And so what I'm hoping is, Yo and I are here telling the younger women, don't keep chasing that perfect state. Don't think you have to be perfect, because it's frankly impossible. Particularly people who have done well in school. You know, you go through elementary school and middle school and high school, and you've done well and you've excelled, and maybe you go to college or not. Maybe you choose a career where that's not a prerequisite, and you continue to do well, and you think, I've got to keep, you know, checking the boxes. Yeah. I thought of, you know, my whole life was just chasing the next step. Mm-hmm. And it was trying to get into a great college, trying to get into a great law school, trying to get that great first job. And I have to be perfect. And once I get there, it will make me happy. And what I've learned, I'm here to tell everybody that it's just not going to happen. You're never going to get to that place where you think, okay, I'm here, I'm done, and everything is okay now. You know, we look out and we see, for me, it was seeing women who were older and more senior than me, the few that there were, who had what looked like really perfect lives. And I thought, that's what I want. If I can just get there, then everything is going to somehow magically be okay. And I'm not going to have all these struggles and doubts, and I'm not going to feel like I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm not going to doubt myself. And what I found through my life and my good couple of very close girlfriends' lives is that it's just not an attainable state. It's not an end goal. You have to enjoy every day, and happiness is in finding the good in every stage of life and every week and every year.
One of the things that, you know, I read your book and then we had our planning call, mm-hmm. But one of the things that have really stuck with me from your book, and it's come up a few times for me, is the point you make, like, we think other women are perfect, mm-hmm. and they have it all together, mm-hmm. and we just don't. We're the loser. And that comparison is a killer.
And it is.
And you make the point, nobody has it all together.
That is exactly right. And I got permission. Here's where I'll have to tell a few stories. I got permission from my couple of close girlfriends to share some stories in the book because I think it is so important for us to realize that everybody has things that they're going through. Everybody struggles. We're all just trying to get through the day, the week, the month. And certainly there are people who have a much harder time in life than I had. There are people who didn't have access to the things that I had access to. So this isn't a pity party, but just to understand, particularly for younger women or women earlier in their career, that what you see out there, what you see in social media, obviously, is not the whole picture. We all know, we've all been in that place where, you take 15 pictures to find the perfect one, or heaven forbid, you take 300 pictures to find the perfect one. That is really an analogy for life. We see, I'll tell a story, a very good friend of mine who was a few years behind me in fairly early in our careers, who she looked up and thought I had it all figured out. She thought, it was a late night conference room somewhere in a high rise in Chicago, and she was maybe 6 months out of school, so very early in her career. The first big project of her career. And we were working on it together. And one day, evening, late night in this conference room, I kind of saw that look on her face. And I see, like her lips start to quiver and she's batting her eyelashes. And I said, "Come here." And I kind of pulled her aside. And I said, "Are you okay? What's going on?" And she just started unloading, "I can't do this. The hours are too much. This is too much. I look at you, Christine, and I see your clothes are pressed and your hair is dyed and your nails are done," or whatever it was. "You don't seem rattled. You know what you're doing. How are you doing this? How are you keeping this all together?" And it was, I think, incredibly vulnerable for her
Oh yeah.
to do all of that. I think she was kind of at that breaking point, to be
Yeah, like
honest.
it didn't care anymore.
Didn't care anymore. Like,
Right.
I'm just gonna say the truth, and whatever
Exactly.
it is." And she said, "None of this. I'm running out of clean clothes, and I don't have any food to eat for dinner because this project was just sort of all consuming." And she said, "I look at you and you've got this all together." And I just smiled and I said, "I am so far from together." And I let her in on, at that time, my big secret was my mom. I was probably 30-ish years old, late 20s, and my mom cleaned my house. My mom did my laundry. She'd take the clothes out of the hamper, wash them. I was so incredibly lucky and blessed that, first, I lived near her. Second, she had the time. Third, she was happy to do it. She would pick up my dry cleaning. She would do whatever I needed. And but for her, there's no way I could have kept all those balls in the air.
No.
And I saw this sort of look of relief go over my girlfriend's face, and she said, "Do you think your mom would do that for me too?" And her family wasn't nearby. And I said, "I don't know, but I'll ask." And that's how my mom got to be sort of a second mom to not only her, but
Oh,
to one other of our colleagues.
how
So,
sweet and so
and she's the best.
supportive. Oh my
So
gosh.
supportive, so supportive. And the irony is, now that friend is a very senior person at her company. She has a really big, important job where she has incredible responsibilities. I see things she's working on in
Good for
the
her.
press. And she has three boys, and she always looks great and never seems frazzled to the public. In those moments where she and I grab lunch, she'll let her guard down and say, "Oh my gosh, I've got to text this person and do this and make sure the carpool picks up that kid, and I've got to get this kid to travel baseball." And she is constantly juggling.
Yeah.
But to the world, all they see is, in the book I call her Carrie, all they see is Carrie living this incredible life with this great career and these three boys who are doing great things. And they have no idea what it takes every day for her to keep all of that together. So I tell that story and a few others in the book. There's some funny stories about when Carrie's kids were little and all of the mishaps of just trying to keep it all together as a parent and a worker and a friend and a sister and a mom and a daughter and trying to keep all those balls in the air. It is not easy for anybody, even people whose lives look pretty perfect. They struggle too, I promise.
That was so good to read, though. You know, when I was reading that, I went, oh boy, this is so good. Because we do, when we were social beings, we compare, we look, you know, we're always thinking this or that. And you talk a little bit too about beliefs, and probably that's a good one, right? That we could shift about, you know, that we need to have it all together.
Very true.
Are there other beliefs in there that you think we have to, you know, would be very helpful to shift so we could have that more of the balance?
Absolutely. And of course, I'm using words throughout this podcast of men, women, boys, girls, and that I realize that's very binary. I realize that's not the way all people see themselves or view themselves or want to be referred to. I use those words because the data and the studies use those categories of people, but certainly gender is a spectrum, and I appreciate and honor all of that. But in general, women, what the research and the data and the studies tell us is that women of a different set of beliefs about themselves and their abilities, we tend to doubt ourselves more. We tend to be less confident. We tend to speak in asks rather than statements. We tend to not dream as big as men do. We tend to not go for things, not have that sort of, I got this kind of attitude. And it runs in huge ways and tiny ways. And I'll give you just one tiny little example. My husband recently said to me, we were at a restaurant and the waiter stepped away from taking our order. And my husband said to me in the course of this book, he's been extremely helpful. He said, do you realize how you order food at a restaurant? And at first I thought, what are you talking about? That's a weird thing to say. And he said, every time you order, you say, can I have the steak? And he said, the steak's on the menu. Of course you can have the steak. Whereas he would say, I would like the steak. And in little ways, every day, in little ways, I catch myself doing that. I'll be writing an email to someone and I'll do the just checking in to see if you've had a chance language.
Yeah, just
yes. And just, I'm sorry to be a bother. I'm sorry to ask, even though you owe this to me and I was expecting it and this is the deadline. Whereas my husband would just say, hey, I haven't gotten your report yet on X.
Yeah.
When can I expect it? I would backpedal and be nice about it and soft about it. So in all those little ways, what on the aggregate, the data tells us is that women tend to, you know, we tend to minimize our demands. We tend to ask permission. We tend to not go for things. And we tend to not have that kind of confidence or belief in ourselves that men do.
Well, I just saw something happen just this past week to me where our gardener, because I think there's a cult there for me too. There's a cultural thing here too, because I'm Latina and our gardener is also Latino, and he was going to get some ground cover. And he said, you know, I think we could put some ground cover down here. And I said, oh, okay. And I went in the house, and then he showed up with three guys and put the ground cover. I never asked for an estimate. I was people pleasing the whole way, trying to be very charming. And I talked to my husband about it. And I said, you know, when I was in my job as a VP of marketing, I was very demanding. I wanted estimates. I wanted invoices. I want the whole thing. But then I fell apart. It was like, what happened to that woman? And she becomes this very accommodating, nice person to be around.
And I think that's so common. Absolutely.
I think so. I mean, I saw it definitely in myself and how I lost a bit of that request, you know, like a sharp request or, you know, what to expect here. And I want everybody to like me. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm reverting to this mushy woman. Like, come on, you know?
It's and
like,
I think that's exactly it. Yeah, it's exactly it. You want, we have this tendency to be people pleasers, to want people to like you. And I think a lot of that comes from culture, from society, from the way we are raised. You know, we're taught to be polite and smile and pretty, and boys are taught to be strong and bold. You know, a little boy runs around and, you know, breaks things or, you know, swinging his sticks around the yard and dirty faced and all of that. And we say, oh, they're such boys, or they talk firmly, or they're aggressive. And we just attributed that to some maleness in them.
Yeah.
But women, we, you know, little girls, we expect them to be more gentle and soft, and we buy them baby dolls and Barbie dolls and teach them to brush hair and all of those kinds of things. So I think a lot of that is just inherently subconsciously in us, that we're not supposed to be loud. If I could tell you how many times when I was a little kid that, you know, teachers would tell my mom that I was bossy. You know, Christine's, you know, she's a great student, but she's really bossy, or she's, you know, she's loud. And to my mom, that was kind of a compliment. She would say, good, I'm glad she's stating her mind. But in the teacher's mind, that's not how girls act. You know, girls shouldn't take charge. And I think it's really hard for us to shed all of those beliefs. You know, there are plenty of social scientists from incredible universities around the world who study these things. Like, what is it about gender that makes a difference in how people, whether it's problem solving or leadership roles, or one that stands out in my mind so brightly is applying for a job. So there's a now pretty famous study that was first done by HP, Fortune 500 company. And they wanted to find out where they were losing women. Why don't we have more women in senior roles? So one of the things that they did, which became sort of a phenomenon in the social science literature, was they did a deep dive into the applications for jobs, and looked across all different kinds of departments, different geographies, different levels, from low level positions to very high level positions, and diced the data and studied what is it different, what's different about the way men approach applying for a job and women. And what they found was that based on a job spec or specification or criteria, if a position said, we're looking for someone with 5 years of experience, who has a bachelor's degree in marketing, who has done these kind of projects before, that when they looked at the data, women would only apply for that position if they met every single one of the stated criteria, which I know I certainly did. If something said 5 years of experience and I only had two, I would have thought, oh, well, I'm not qualified. I can't submit my resume for that. But when they looked at that same job and looked at the male applicants, the men applied for that job when they met only about 60% of the criteria. So there's something going on there.
Exactly.
You know, women, we won't go for it unless we're completely qualified or overqualified, as in, again, broad categorization. There are certainly some women who don't act this way at all. But this data among thousands of job applications shows us that we don't go for it unless we are completely qualified or overqualified. They found a pretty large segment of women who had 7 or 9 years of experience versus guys applying with 1 or 2. And that men just don't view it that way. They take those risks. They have this, I can do this kind of belief in themselves that just wasn't present in the data set for the women. And I think about that every single time there's something that I think is scary or frightening or out of reach or that I'm not qualified for. I think, how would a guy do this? A guy would think, I can do that. And they would go for it. So I hope that story will resonate and will recur in people's minds the next time your listeners are looking at a promotion that they want to say, I think I should be considered for that promotion, or looking at a job posting, or looking at getting into college or graduate school or med school or whatever it is, just to go in with that kind of
confidence.
I'm a little better than halfway qualified, so I'm going to try.
Yeah, building the confidence muscle,
building
right?
The confidence. Just
that confidence doesn't mean to have 100%. You can have, what is it, 60%? Let's do that.
And there's a difference between confidence and arrogance, of course. But just to have that, let's go for it. Let's try. I have a niece who right now is a junior in college. I've got 7 nieces, ranging from 18 to 33. And she is really interested in being a veterinarian. This is what she's wanted to do since she was a little kid and started volunteering at the Humane Society. Vet schools are incredibly difficult to get into. I didn't realize until I started talking with people a few years ago when she continued to express this interest. It's harder to get in, statistically harder to get into vet school than medical school.
Wow.
And a lot harder than getting into law school. There are only about 40 vet schools in the country. And so she was talking with me. I really want to do this. I don't think for X, Y, or Z school, I might not meet their criteria. And I said, you've got to try. You apply to every single one that you're interested in. What is the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is you get a no. Well, then you're in the same place you are if you didn't even try.
Yeah.
So if you do apply, maybe you'll get in. Maybe you'll get waitlisted. But I promise you, if you don't submit your application, you've got zero chance. So give yourself better than zero chance and go for it. So I'm fingers crossed and hoping and praying that she gets into the school of her dreams. But if she didn't go for it and didn't say, I'm just going to give this a shot, even though it's harder than being a doctor, it would never happen.
Yeah.
So I want people to kind of embrace that.
So we'll end today's episode here, but there's more to come with Christine in our next episode. Thank you for listening today, and we sure hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please leave a comment wherever you listen to your podcasts, tell a friend about us, join our public Facebook group, Girl Take the Lead, or visit our website, girltaketheleadpod.com. We also have a YouTube channel where your subscription would be appreciated. Once you're on YouTube, search at Girl Take the Lead. And we've recently expanded to YouTube Music, where you can find a video of this episode. So there's 3 takeaways from the series. 1, we can't have it all. And trying to be perfect robs us of our own happiness. Others that we think have it all really don't. 2, we can begin to change our lives by changing a few beliefs within ourselves. Be determined, be ambitious, believe in yourself, and take chances, just like Elle Woods did. And 3, quitting is not failure, but can be the only way to achieve success in the long term. Thanks again for being here, and talk to you soon. Bye.